This is the Vorpal Network.
Welcome to Dice Monkey Radio. This is Mark. And joining me this week is Michael, the online DM.
Hi, everybody.
And Michael is a fairly new blogger. You've been blogging for how long now?
About a year and a half. I started April of 2010.
Okay, so not that new. But you have a very specific niche on your blog.
Yeah, so I started blogging mainly because I was still fairly new to playing D&D altogether. I really only started at the beginning of 2010. And started a game when I was visiting some friends in Florida. I live in Colorado, and we had a good time playing together, but we were all just together for a friend's wedding and wanted to keep playing. So we decided we'd try to play online, and I started blogging to chronicle my discovery of the ways you can play D&D and other RPGs online and different tools that are available and just what it's like to play online games.
Okay. And you really, the main focus is using map tools.
Yeah, there's a program called MapTool that I've been using for not the entire time I've been playing. I actually started off with a program called OpenRPG and soon discovered another program called GameTable, and I liked GameTable better. And in doing a little bit of research about tips and tricks for GameTable, I saw a lot of people talking online about a program called MapTool. And as soon as I tried out MapTool, I realized this is the one. This is what I've been looking for. MapTool is a free program. Don't have to pay a dime for it. There's a really good community around it, people who've built entire frameworks to let you play games with the rules already programmed in, like D&D, but also Savage Worlds and Pathfinder and other games like that. So if you just want it all in a box, it's there for you for free. But if you like to tinker and you like to create some of your own code and your own macros and your own ways of doing things, MapTool is very, I wouldn't say it's easy, there's definitely a learning curve, but it lets you do that. And I've had a lot of fun writing macros and learning how the program works and using it in my own games.
Excellent. And this episode, we're actually going to be talking pretty much exclusively about online gaming. So we're definitely going to come back and discuss even more. We're going to discuss macros and the other things you mentioned. But for now, let's go ahead and move on to the news. Okay, first up in news, Amazon is known for putting up when a product is coming out long before it actually does and before Wizards gets around to ever announcing it. So one of the things that was brought to my attention on Twitter was there's a new book coming out called Into the Unknown, The Dungeon Survival Handbook. That's May 15th of 2012. Have you looked at this at all?
Yeah, I've looked at the page on Amazon, and I know that Matt James is involved in it, and I'd seen some things that he'd put up on Twitter and other places where he'd kind of hinted about projects he was working on that he was excited about, so I'm guessing that this is probably what he was referring to, although I think, you know, he's a freelancer, he does a lot of different projects. And I've seen a little bit of discussion over on EN World and other places where people were talking about earlier Dungeon Survival handbooks from different editions and how this one might be similar or different. So I don't really know what to expect, but all I've seen so far in detail is the cover art, which looks pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's go ahead and start some rampant speculation.
All right.
What do you think is in this book? Because they've got the Heroes... What's that book called? The Heroes Guidebook or...
Yeah, the player's strategy guide, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, I didn't read the player's strategy guide. I read about it, and I'm mostly a dungeon master these days, so I don't get a chance to play much. And honestly, I think I'm one of those players who has the tendency to, I could be an optimizer, and I try to fight that. So I try to avoid that book.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there might be any similarity there, or I'm not really sure what exactly this book is going to be covering.
Well, I think the player strategy guide, as I remember, seemed to be mainly about, you know, optimizing your character, you know, the best way to maximize damage or healing or whatever it is you want to do with your character. Based on the name, Into the Unknown, the Dungeon Survival Handbook, I hope that it might be a little more fluff-heavy, probably. So a little bit more about, you know, what it's like to be an adventurer, what it's like to, I mean, obviously it's about dungeons, so underground adventuring and things like that, maybe some gear and that sort of thing, but probably less about optimizing a character. I don't really expect to see a ton of that, but you never know.
Yeah. I expect that there will probably be some more items in there. The Mordenkainen's Magical Emporium introduced a lot more mundane items into the game, but I think they might expand that even further. I could imagine them adding a lot more different random mundane items, different things that create different light sources and things like that.
Oh yeah, you're surviving in a dungeon, you need food sources, you need light sources, you need shelter. I could totally see them having lots of mundane and minor magical items like that.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to seeing what exactly it entails.
Yeah, now do you think there will be any crunch? I mean, do you expect to see, you know, feats or you know, powers for various classes, anything like that, or themes perhaps?
I definitely think that there will be some feats in there. That's pretty much a given with anything that's ever come out that's been third edition or fourth edition. So pretty much everything that they've ever made has some type of feat. But I could definitely see some dungeoneering type themes.
Yeah.
And then maybe a few powers here and there for various classes. Definitely like the rogue and things like that would work well with getting some different themes or powers like that.
Yeah, I think of those, I'd guess that themes are going to be, as far as crunch goes, that's probably one that will be there and will probably get a fair amount of attention when the book comes out, assuming they do have themes, because themes have been just crazy popular the last year or so.
Oh, yeah.
Have you used themes much in your games?
All my players have a theme that they chose at the beginning, but they haven't really paid much attention to it. Most of my players are new, and so they look at the character sheets and act as if every single time their turn comes around, they act as if they've never looked at the character sheet before.
that slows the game down somewhat.
Yeah. So they haven't really explored their themes much and the themes that they chose were very, very straightforward, exactly what you'd expect out of what they had chosen for their class.
Okay.
And their race. But actually this is coming out only a month before I move back to Spokane, Washington, my hometown. So I may end up picking this up, and it probably won't see the light of day at this game table, but more likely than not, I'll definitely see it at the game table in Spokane.
I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what they have in store for us. I mean, some good authors on board. I know Logan Bonner and Matt James have both done great stuff. Amazon lists RPG Team as one of the authors, so who knows what that means. But I think it'll be I'm interested to see what they have.
Yeah, me too. Next, we've got The Legend of Drizzt. Which is the new board game that they've brought out. This one it looks like it's using the same rules as Wrath of Ashardalon and Castle Ravenloft.
Yes, this is another one of their adventure system board games, I believe is the name for it. And I've not played Legend of Drizzt yet, although I do have Wrath of Ashardalon and Castle Ravenloft, and have had a really good time with those as an alternative to D&D when you don't have anything prepared. You know, I think that they're great for, we got our friends together, would love to do some adventuring, the DM isn't ready, but we can still do this. And I think The Legend of Drizzt probably continues in that vein.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to play actually any of them, but I've looked over the pieces and I've looked over how the rules work. They look really cool, and the miniatures that they've chosen are really, really nice. So I'm glad that they've got the really nice sculpts. That dragon that appears in Wrath of Ashardalon, I actually have the official D&D mini.
The
painted up one. So
it was based on an earlier sculpt?
Yes. Actually, gotcha. I think almost all of them are based on a previous sculpt, which is nice because if you already got that sculpt, then it helps bolster. You can always use an extra dragon.
Sure, you can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a big minis guy myself because, well, we'll talk about later the software I use, but they are cool. I mean, I love the toy value. And I'll also say one thing that this whole adventure system has going for it is it's a pretty low commitment, easy on-ramp way to let somebody try out a game like D&D, because the rules are very much like D&D 4th edition. You still have some at-will powers and then some sort of daily powers, and the movement rules are similar. And, you know, move minor, well, there's no minor action, but move and standard action on a turn. And I actually used that to introduce my brother-in-law when he and his family were visiting my family over Christmas last year to D&D, and from that he became hooked, and then his wife became hooked, and since then we've had an ongoing game with my wife, my wife's brother, and then his wife playing together online.
Awesome.
And it was all thanks to that on-ramp from Castle Ravenloft.
Cool. One thing I'd love to see is them take the character builder and allow you to make characters for these board games, so you could take your own characters from D&D and be able to play them in the board game.
that's a cool idea. Yeah, have ways to adapt the powers so that they work in the game rules. Because, you know, the damage is different. You only have, like, 8 hit points instead of, you know, 25 plus at first level. But yeah, you could totally do that. That's a neat idea.
I think it'd be really, really cool because I know that with Descent, Journeys into the Darkness, which is by Fantasy Flight, they had on their website the ability to make your own characters. And I ended up taking my Eladrin Sword Mage and made him in Descent so that if we ever got a chance to sit down and play it, that I'd be able to pull that character out. And there was very specific rules on how to make the character and everything like that. And he fit right into the about the same power level as everybody else. So
yeah, that's a great idea. Cool. You get the board game feel where there are pre-made characters. And like I said, it's an easy on-ramp. You don't have to learn a rule book like you would with reading the player's handbook or something like that before you play. But if you have those optional rules to let you customize and make your own character, I think that'll make it even more immersive and, again, a better bridge to playing the actual RPG.
Oh, yeah. And then if you had the group who everybody's able to make it but one guy and it's a really important part, everybody just pulls out their characters for the board game. Mm-hmm. And your characters can all still go on an adventure together.
Yeah, I could see that being an optional rule they bring out for their adventure system games, whether through the character builder or just something, you know, a separate add-on set of rules. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then I saw that with the very first scenario I saw in the video that they have on their website, that the very first scenario is a one-person scenario. It's you playing Drist escaping from the Underdark.
Yeah, they've made it possible in all the games to have, I believe there's the option for solo play in all of them, but in the Drizzt one, that's cool. I mean, I think it lets you get a feel for the character, which I'll admit, I know very little about. I've not read the Drizzt books, and I've only gotten the feel from the D&D community that he's a bit of a overused character that people don't love that much for those who've been around a long time. But it does sound like that'd be an interesting way to get people who don't know about the character a little bit of feel for his background in the action there.
Yeah, exactly. It allows them to experience the Mary Sue of the Forgotten Realms. Let's go ahead and talk about... Actually, there's a couple more that we didn't mention that I didn't mention to you before the show. There's coming up is the player's option, Heroes of the Feywild.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of talk about this over on Twitter.
Oh, yes.
You can now play a fairy.
A pixie.
A centaur, I believe.
I think that's right.
One of the new races. And there's a few others.
I believe there's a dryad of some sort.
Yeah.
Something like that. I don't remember all the options, but the pixie, I know, is the one that's gotten the most attention.
Yeah. What do you think about people being able to play a pixie?
Well, you know, I'm okay with it. I think that it's gotten mocked roundly by a lot of people, and I'm a little more relaxed than that because, frankly, I've been at a couple of game tables in the last few weeks where there have been people who've been excited about the idea of playing a pixie. You know, my wife is interested in playing a pixie, and she's already a gamer. It's not like this would be what gets her into D&D. She actually got me into D&D, but I know she's interested, and some other people at the friendly local game store I've heard have talked about the idea. And I think that they've clearly designed the race with an eye on balance. You know, they can't fly to only one square height, I think. And I think that there's some creative options available by using the shrink power and things like that.
Yeah, I don't really see a problem with it. I've actually, for a while, thought it'd be kind of cool to be able to play. You know, if you were to be somebody really, really tiny, what role would be perfect for that? And that would be the assassin.
Yes, definitely.
Be playing a pixie assassin, going in, nobody knows you're there, sneaking in and being able to, you know, throw little poison daggers the size of a thumbtack at people.
That's a great idea. And I mean, I'm sure some people will go for laughs and try to be the, you know, the pixie barbarian or the pixie, you know, fighter, that kind of thing, which is fine. And I do think the pixie is one of those races, and you can't really control this if you're going to be at in an organized play event where you don't know who your other players are. But it's one of those races that I think it'd be weird if you had too many of them in the party. You know, one or two pixies would be fine. But if you have a party that's, I suppose you could do the all-pixie campaign on purpose, but if you show up to a table in a standard adventure that's not made for an all-pixie campaign and the whole party is, you know, these tiny little creatures that are flitting about, I have a hard time envisioning what that would look like in-world. That seems odd to me.
Yeah. One thing that I've discussed previously on the blog is that 4th edition really allows for reskinning really, really easily.
Hmm.
So if you don't like a pixie, why not reskin it without changing any rules at all? You've suddenly got a pseudo dragon instead.
That's great. See, that's one that I think the people who don't like the flavor of the Pixie could totally get behind. And I think if you want to do a pseudo dragon, have you already statted this up on your blog?
No, because there really wouldn't have to be any stat changes at all. You have the ability to fly. You have your fairy magic, which would instead just be the fact that you're, you know, a pseudo dragon and have magic, things like that. And then you make sure that you choose something like a wizard or something who is able to throw fireballs, and suddenly your pseudo dragon is breathing fire.
Sure.
Previously, in a previous campaign, I had a player who was playing a pirate. There's no pirate class, and so he was a ranger, which allowed him to take the the two weapons, so he carried in his two cutlasses and everything like that.
Sure.
It's really, really easy to make a blink dog in 4th edition, where you just choose an Eladrin, who right. also happens to have... You also choose, like, the warlock or the sword mage, who teleports a lot. Mm-hmm. It's really, really easy to change things, and then their magical weapons that they're carrying are actually just... You know, part of them, their
right, teeth and claws,
and things like that, yeah. and they well, I would enchant say their teeth. You know,
I think the pseudo dragon idea for reskinning a pixie is a great one. Although I would say the pixies, I think it's called the pixie dust power, where they get to make somebody else fly. You wouldn't want to give them the full on dragon breath that a dragonborn would get. I think that's probably too powerful,
yeah.
Given their other abilities. But maybe a more limited dragon breath, you know, a smaller blast area, or maybe a single target, or something along those lines. Just because yeah. if I'm a dragon, I want to be able to shoot out a little jet of flame, even if I'm a small dragon.
Yeah, that's true. Making it just a single space.
Yeah, you can have it be a close blast three, but one target in the blast or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, so it's still, you shoot one little jet of flame instead of a big burst of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There you go. You've set it up a new race.
There we go. Mark. Now you've got a pseudo dragon, and you can go by Heroes of the Feywild and not get laughed at. And then also the Book of Vile Darkness is coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Did you own the previous Book of Vile Darkness?
I did not. So my history with D&D is that I played a little bit of 3.0, so probably about 8 or 9 years ago. This is before 3.5 came out, but never really got an ongoing group, and so didn't do too much with it. So I did see the Book of Vile Darkness in stores. I think it was out at that time,
yeah.
but never really looked at it.
Yeah, the Book of Vile Darkness and the Book of Exalted Deeds both had big stickers on them saying that they had mature content inside. The mature content in the Book of Exalted Deeds was that they talked about good and evil and what is good and what is evil, and they thought would be a little bit controversial, so they wanted only more mature players to read it. And then the Book of Vile Darkness was the same, except that it included rules for torture and poison, and then had the occasional monster who had bared breasts, but it wasn't anything worse than you would have seen in first edition AD&D.
Sure. So what do you think the role of the Book of Vile Darkness is going to be for a 4th edition game? Will this be, I assume it's a supplement for Dungeon Masters than for players?
I think so. I believe, yeah, it's going to be a 32-page...
Facsimile?
I can never say that correctly. Facsimile.
Got it. Facsimile. Got it.
Yeah. Of the Book of Vile Darkness. So it's going to look like the real Book of Vile Darkness.
Okay.
Which in the 3rd edition rules, if a good character looked at it, I think they instantly died. And with the Book of Exalted Deeds, if an evil character looked at, then they died, or it was something terrible happened to them.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. Then there's going to be a 96-page supplement that's going to allow dungeon masters to roll with sample role-playing encounters, adventure hooks, skill challenges, rituals, and lore, and then new character options for players who like to flirt with evil.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's going to be the poster maps and everything. But I think that this will work really, really well to be combined with the Shadowfell book.
So, I was thinking the same thing, yeah. Because I do have that. I did get the Shadowfell box set. I haven't really used it much yet. Mm-hmm. And I know that it's, you know, if you want a sort of a creepier game, there's definitely, you know, good material there for you. I mean, really, the Shadowfell box set was a setting. It was the City of Gloomrot and a lot of information about it. And it was very well done, you know, but it wasn't... Mm-hmm. The whole Shadowfell, and maybe the Book of Vile Darkness will help you if you want to have a wider ranging, you know, dark campaign.
Yeah, and I think you know, allowing somebody who's a vampire to get, you know, these different more evil abilities or things mm-hmm. like that. Somebody who's playing a shifter, so they can be a werewolf.
True.
Things like that.
Well, the vampire, that's a good point, too, because I know one of the complaints of the vampire class is that it's very limited. You don't get a lot of choices, so maybe you'll have some options in the Book of Vile Darkness.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. And then there's... I've heard that it's going to be lighter on its whole thing than the previous edition. They're trying to keep fourth edition a bit more
family friendly.
Yeah, family friendly. So yeah. I assume it'll probably have more rules for poisons, more diseases, which is always good. I don't think the diseases get used nearly enough.
I couldn't agree more. I am a big fan of diseases in fourth edition, and I think that I'd love to see. Honestly, have they even given good guidance on how to make your own diseases?
No, not at all.
Yeah, sort of have to look at what's out there and go from there.
There's been some great rules that out there that people have made for getting drunk, using the disease tracks for
sure,
getting drunk and things like that. So
cursed or things along those lines. Yeah.
And so there's really good ways that people have used it, but there's no really hard and fast rules that they've had. So maybe introducing something like that might be a good thing that they might do.
Maybe, yeah. I'm not going to count on it in this book, but you never know. Maybe I could see a Dungeon Magazine article or something like that.
Yeah. So I think that's about it. There's one last piece of news. I actually just finished, finally, I've actually been working on it for like a year now, on and off, the Veil of Secrecy, which is my new spy role-playing game. It's using the Worm Rule system by Stargazer Games. That it was for Warrior, Rogue, and Mage.
Mm-hmm.
So I've made a spy version of that. I've added in a lot of rules myself. It's going to be released Creative Commons, and currently it just needs to get laid out. It's currently in a .doc format, but we're going to make it look pretty. So it's going to be officially released. Yeah, it's going to be officially released through Stargazer Games. And it's also has art being done by Stuart Robertson of Robertson Games, who, if you've seen his Weird West role-playing game that he sells for 99 cents, his art style is very, very Mike Mignola from Hellboy.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, really nice, cool, jagged lines, deep shadows, things like that. So he's going to be working on the cover. That should be done. The cover should be done soon, hopefully. Mm-hmm. And I'll be working on doing all the layout and stuff like that. So,
hopefully, something you plan to have out before the end of the year?
I'm hoping so, but I had planned on having it out before the end of the year last year. So,
the best laid plans at all.
Exactly.
Well, that's exciting. So, well, congratulations on finishing it up. I can't wait to have a look.
Thanks. And I think that's it for the news. So, we're going to go ahead and move into a word from our sponsor, and we will be right back.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more, Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
Welcome back, and we're going to go ahead and talk about online gaming. You said you've been gaming online for 1.5, 2 years?
Yeah, about a year and a half now.
Okay. And you started off initially with the RPG.
Yeah, OpenRPG.
OpenRPG. Now, how does that differ from what you're currently using?
Well, so OpenRPG is another free system. I haven't actually paid for any of the gaming packages out there, although I do know about several of them. But OpenRPG has one feature that's great, and that is you don't have to deal with setting up your IP addresses and making sure that your players can connect to your computer as the DM. There's just there's servers out there, and everybody wants to connect to the same server. So it's kind of a nice feature if you have trouble with your router, things like that. And I did use it once when my wife and I were vacationing in Boston and wanted to play some D&D with our friends online, and we were in a hotel. And, of course, on the hotel, you can't change your router settings to map certain ports to come to your computer, so we went to OpenRPG. The downside of OpenRPG is that you have to load up everything onto the server in advance. So all of your maps, all of your images you're going to use for the monsters or the characters, any objects you want to throw at them, all have to be set up somewhere online first. And it's kind of tricky with resizing them and things like that too. So you have a grid, it's a certain, you know, 50 pixels per square or 100 pixels per square. You got to make sure that all of your tokens are scaled to the right size to work with that grid.
Okay.
It's a bit of a pain in the butt compared to some other systems. Mm-hmm. So I only used that one for, I think, two or three sessions. And then I discovered a tool called GameTable, which I believe there was some dispute over the name, and I've also seen it under the name OSU-GT, OSU-GT. I don't really know what that's all about. But GameTable is nice in that it's a very simple whiteboard, and the default background that everybody's looking at with this shared tabletop looks like one of those ChessX mats, you know, the kind of modeled tan color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's a really nice, you know, look and feel to it. And it's pretty easy to, you know, drag stuff to the tabletop, like wall objects, or to draw on the surface with basically, you know, crayon-like tools, nothing super fancy. So you can whip up a map in a hurry and drag some tokens to the table, and you can even set up some very basic dice macros with your tokens. So you could have one macro that is roll an attack roll for my sword, and then another one that's a damage roll for my sword, and it'll display the result in the chat window.
That's cool.
So I like GameTable for that. It's very straightforward and simple. But then I discovered MapTool, which is also free, and it's at rptools.net for those who want to download it. And it's currently on version 1.3.b87, I think, which is the most recent version. And it's fantastic in that it can do everything GameTable does with the, you know, shared space that everybody can see, and macros, but better. And it's to the point that you can, first of all, draw really nice-looking maps in it without too much difficulty, because you can zoom in and out on the grid as you see fit and change the size of the grid if you want. There's files out there with tons of background images and textures and all sorts of stuff for dungeon dressing and houses and animals and monsters and you know, bricks and wood and dirt and trees and all sorts of things that you'd want for an adventure map. And you can download a big pack of these things and create your own maps really easily and edit them on the fly. So if I decide I want a tree over here, great, I'll just grab a tree object and drag it onto the table and boom, there we go. And so for me, I'm not a very great artist. I mean, I don't draw. I'm not very good at it. But I can make some nice looking maps that I'm happy to use with my players and not feel embarrassed about it in MapTool without a lot of effort.
Excellent. Now, on your website, you do a lot with macros. Do you want to talk about macros and what those can do?
Sure. So some people, I want to put a caveat out there for anybody listening, thinking about gaming online. MapTool can be simple. You can use it as a dead simple shared table that everybody can see and just draw line maps on it and drag tokens around. And when it's time for you to attack, you roll your dice and say, okay, I got a 13 plus 6 is a 19 versus armor class. Does that hit? And so on. You can do that, and that's absolutely fine. But if you want to, you can program in MapTool. And it uses, I believe it's based on Java or JavaScript. I'm not a programming expert there, so I don't know too much about it. But what I've generally done with MapTool is a few things. One is I've set up properties for tokens, like how many hit points they have, that type of thing. And then macros on each token where you can click a little button that says take damage. And it'll give a little pop-up and say how much damage you're taking. You say 6, and then it will update your hit points. So very simple stuff like that, same for gaining hit points and gaining temporary hit points. I've also set up states. You can set up states on tokens, like a token is bloodied or weakened or dazed or slowed. And you have little icons appear on the token to show you what states are currently on it. And so I have little macros that will turn the state on or turn the state off when you toggle it. But the most useful thing, I think, has been I have macros that will handle attacks. So if I have a fighter and they have a particular brass strike or something along those lines, that fighter's token will have a brass strike button on it. And whenever the player who is the fighter is using their fighter, they can drag it around on the map and then say, okay, I'm going to brass strike this guy. And they click the brass strike button, and it will roll. In the little chat window, it'll say, brass strike, you rolled a 6 plus 11 is 17 versus armor class. And if it hits, here's the damage and any other effects. So I do that for all the PCs and, more importantly, all the monsters. And what I love about this is that it's really fast. I never have to worry about sitting there and doing the math and say, wait, 20 plus I got a crit, so that hits. But if it's a 16, I got to add 11. That's 27. What was that again with the damage? And rolling the dice and taking the time. So it does make the game go faster to have all the math done just like that when you click the button. But the game will still show you, here were the dice that were rolled and here were the results that you got. So I really like that. It's a big time saver, and it makes the game go fast so that you can have more fun in less time.
And one of the big complaints about 4th edition that people have had is that the difficulty that there is in how long combats take. Mm-hmm. Do you find that it cuts the time in half, or
I wouldn't say in half. I'd say that I probably save about, I'll call it 20% of my time. So my combats, I'd say, if it would be normally an hour-long combat, I can probably do it in a little less than 50 minutes, that kind of thing. And I notice it more when I'm using Map Tool for an in-person game. I guess I could talk about the whole projector setup I use. But so what I do when I'm gaming in person is, I got into D&D, like I said, a year and a half ago, and I didn't have a collection of minis for monsters. And I realized that if I'm going to be DMing, I'm either going to need to get a collection of minis, or, since I was just getting into Map Tool then, I could just get a projector, and then I project a map onto the table. And my projector rig is portable, and we can have a link to the post about that in the show notes.
Yeah.
But so I take it down to the local game store or to local conventions, or, of course, you know, use it at home too. And I just hook up the projector, hook it up to my laptop where I have Map Tool running, and then the map is on the table. And that means that not only is the map there, but also the monsters are there. So for all my monsters, it's a little digital image of, you know, a goblin or a dragon or whatever you might be fighting. Mm-hmm. And my end of the battle is a lot easier. So I keep track of initiative in Map Tool, and I also keep track of all the monsters' attacks and all the monsters' hit points and all the states on the monsters that way. But the players are still using minis for their tokens, and they'll still keep track of their own hit points and everything as they normally would. So I only get the speed up on my end of it, but I will definitely say that when I'm running a game, let's say Living Forgotten Realms game at the local store that is supposed to take 4 hours, I mean, it's up to 4 hours. So usually you should be able to finish it faster, but I will generally finish one of those in about 3 hours. And it's fantastic. I mean, you can really get a lot done quickly.
Mm.
Now, when I play online, my players, of course, are using Map Tool too, so they have their tokens in Map Tool. And I will still say that what takes most of the time in D&D, I mean, the math helps. Having that done for you is great. But most of it is just making decisions. You know, I could move to here or I could move to there. Do I want to use this encounter power now? Do I want to wait until my buddy moves into this position first? And which of these many powers do I want to use right now? And should I use a magic item ability? And that goes for both me as the DM when I'm running the monsters, although I have fewer choices, and then the players, of course. So it still takes time to make those decisions. And I know there have been a lot of people who have written about ways to speed up combat, and I think that something like Map Tool, where it streamlines the math, you know, tracking your attack and damage rolls, tracking your hit points, and helping with the tracking of states, definitely helps there. And I don't think you lose much of the fun, unless you just love the feel of dice in your hands, which I totally respect. A lot of people do.
Yeah.
But if that's not a big deal to you, it does remove the math part of a game, but it doesn't remove the decision part of a game. And I think it'd be hard to still have all the tactical complexity of 4th edition and have it be a very fast combat system, just because, especially at higher levels, my main online campaign at mid-Paragon now, they have a lot of choices available to them. So I don't want to take that away from them. And so, you know, we handle the fact that, yeah, combat's going to take a while, and that's okay.
Okay. Excellent. Now, the way that we sort of got in touch with one another, you had been commenting here and there on some of the Dice Monkey posts and things like that, and we started following each other over on Twitter. But the thing that really got us talking was that I was running a game of Star Wars that I decided I was going to run on the Google Plus Hangouts, which basically is just a big whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a bunch of the guys together and started to play, and we very quickly realized that this was not the way to go. And one of the guys was Enrique from Newbie DM,
mm-hmm.
and he suggested that we really, really needed to go do Map Tools, because he's been running his own 4th edition game on there, and he had been in contact with you before about different macros and things like that, and he actually used your 4th edition rule set that you have. What are they called?
A framework.
Framework.
Yeah.
So he had been using your 4th edition framework. We hopped over and we're looking around at that, and you chimed in on Twitter, hey, if you need any help. And yeah, so we ended up bringing you on, and I had to explain the rules for the Star Wars D6 system to you because you were completely unfamiliar.
I'd never played the game. Still haven't, but we'll fix that one of these days.
Exactly. We'll definitely do that. And within probably about 20 minutes, you would come up with the complete framework for exactly how the rules would work with a single macro.
Well, so it sounds like, I mean, Star Wars D6 is an interesting system. I don't know much about the Open D6 system. And I don't want to take all the credit for having a complete framework. I came up with the core macro that lets things work. And basically, now, I'm going to try to explain this, and you tell me if I got this right.
Yeah.
So in Star Wars D6, you'll have different skills, different abilities, different things like that. It could be a strength check or various specialized abilities, and you'll basically have a number associated with that. So if it's 3, then that means when you want to check that skill, you roll 3d6, and if it's 4, you roll 4d6. And when you do, it sounds like the standard rules are you'll roll that many d6, and one of them will be the wild die, and that one is an exploding die. So if you get a 6 on the die, you keep the 6 and you add to it another d6 roll. If you get another 6 on that one, you keep doing it, so it's theoretically unlimited.
Yeah.
Now, so that's relatively easy to do in MapTool because MapTool does have dice macros. It's easy to say, you know, give me a D6, or I will note in MapTool you can do a D13 or D42, whatever you want to do. And I do take advantage of that sometimes. But you can also have the exploding option that's already programmed into MapTool.
Which you just throw an E on the end there.
Exactly. Yeah. If you want to roll a D6, you can just type in the chat window /roll/D6 and it'll give you a D6. If you want an exploding D6, you can type /roll/D6E and it'll give you the result of that. And you can use the same general approach inside macros. It's a little bit different with brackets and things like that, but that's the general dice expressions. Mm-hmm. But the tricky part with the Star Wars D6 system is there's an optional rule that I programmed in to start with, which is if you roll a 1 on the wild die, that the wild die will count as a 0, and it will also cancel out the highest non-wild die you rolled. So if your roll was a 2, a 4, and then a 1 on the wild die, your total would be just a 2, because the 1 on the wild die cancels out your 4. Have I got
exactly.
that right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. So it was a little bit tricky to program up in MapTool, but I was chatting with you guys and trying to do it while I was talking, and then I realized, hang on, I'm just going to drop off of our Skype conversation for a few minutes and figured it out. And yeah, I mean, for those who want to see it, you can definitely see it on my blog. I put up a post about it, and newbie DM Enrique followed up with some thoughts about how to improve it, because you can also add in pips. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah, those little bonus points.
Little plus 2, which is basically if it's a D6 +2, then the highest you could roll is an 8. But you're mm-hmm. always at least guaranteed a 3, which is a nice little bonus when you're playing.
Yeah, so it's easy enough to add in a little thing where it'll give you a pop-up when you say, I want to roll, you know, 3d6, and how many pips do you want? Oh, 2 pips. Great. And it'll give you the result of that. So Enrique added that code, and then he and I went back and forth, and he actually created a really nice-looking framework with some pretty maps in it, and keeping track of the various states of, I guess, damage, you'd call it, to either the characters or starships to show how wounded they are.
Yeah, in Star Wars D6, you don't have hit points. You instead have your characters stunned, wounded, incapacitated, mortally wounded, or killed. So it works a little bit differently than most, and each one ends up causing different effects to happen.
Yeah. So yeah, Enrique had taken some time to put together a nice-looking framework there that actually included those conditions, and I helped him out with the macros to turn those conditions on and off, and ended up with something that I think looks really good. I mean, I don't know the Star Wars D6 system, but it seems like it's a fairly rules-light game, and you have your characters with their abilities, and you can click a button and say, great, I want to roll an ability that's a 4, and it'll give you the result, and off you go.
Yeah, and with using my limited knowledge of the macros, I ended up coming up with my own little macro that was normally if a character becomes incapacitated, they are unconscious for 10 d6 minutes. So I just built a little macro that rolls 10 d6 and it says, this character is unconscious for 36 minutes.
That's excellent. So, see, look at that. You're writing your own macros. I'm so proud of you.
Exactly.
spreading the love of MapTool.
Yeah. So I've actually, and then I've gone through and I've added a lot more tokens and maps for when I'm going to be running games. Currently, the group that I was running before, I got them onto Tatooine. So I ended up scouring the internet and finding any Tatooine maps I could and everything. So I've got a complete set of maps for wherever they happen to go on Tatooine.
Fantastic.
Now, I'm looking right now at the Star Wars D6 charts and tables page, and I wanted to ask you some questions about macros and see if you knew the answer. They've
sure.
got, for example, if somebody wants to do a hit location table, normally for the Star Wars D6 system, it's on a roll of 1, you hit their head. On a 2 to 3, it's their torso. On a 4, it's their arms. On a 5, it's their left leg. On a 6, it's their right leg.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on a 4, it's their arms, so you have to roll again, and on a 1 to 3, it's their left arm, and a 4 to 6, it's their right arm.
Sure.
Can you program a macro that instead of giving you the number, it gives you text of what that means?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, so the way – I can't spit out the code off the top of my head. But the general logic, the way it would work is you would have – you'd probably set up a variable that's your initial hit location role. So hit location equals D6.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would have what's called a switch statement. Mm-hmm. And a switch statement is something that exists in all kinds of programming languages. But it says, okay, I want to turn on a switch based on the result of hit location. And you'd say if the result is 1, then – print head. If the result is 2, 3, print torso, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And then for the case where the result is 4, there'd be some additional code, and the additional code would be, okay, roll another D6 that would be which arm. You just call the variable, which arm equals D6, and you can do another if which arm is less than or equal to 3, then left, otherwise right, and print that result.
Very good. So it's actually the... if you know the code, then it's actually fairly easy to...
it's extremely straightforward.
Pretty much anything.
Yeah.
Excellent.
I wouldn't say anything. There are certain things that are hard. I will say the last week or so, I've been mulling over some macros for 4th edition D&D that would let me track states better, where you get weakened save ends, or you get -2 to your defenses until the end of the monster's next turn, that kind of thing. And I'd like it so that right now, whenever you get weakened, you can click the little weakened button. It'll put a little weakened icon on your token, but it's up to you to remember when that goes away. So since I do track initiative in MapTool, I would like to have it, when you get to the right spot in the initiative order, either pop up a little message in the window that says, hey, your weakened goes away now, or have it even just remove it itself. Or, hey, weakened, you need to make a saving throw against it now, to set those reminders, both for the monsters and for the PCs. So that's a little bit more complicated. I know that there are frameworks out there that do it, but they get more advanced on the coding than I am. So I'm still learning about the really sophisticated stuff, which is, if you ever hear people talking about JSON arrays and JSON objects, that stands for a JavaScript object notation, that stuff gets really complicated. So I'm not there yet.
Okay. Now, for the last year and a half, I've actually been running some games over on RPOL. Have you seen RPOL at all?
I have not.
RPOL is Role Play Online, and with that, it's actually it's basically a big giant forum, but you have a lot of options in there. And if you're looking for doing much more narrative style games, I definitely recommend going and checking that out.
What they call play by post?
Yes.
Yeah, I have done some play-by-post, not on RPOL, on Eon World, but yeah, okay.
With this one, it adds your initial page once you've signed up and everything. It just has news, looking for players, looking for DMs, and that it only shows you specific forums. If you start a new game, it opens up for you to be able to see this new forum, and you don't see any other forums unless you specifically go to them, which keeps it nice and pared down, so you're only seeing the stuff that you're participating in.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows you to actually go in, and as a GM, you can select and you can make new NPCs. And when you post, you can post as a specific NPC. You're able to select pictures. You can put in the stat block for somebody. When you post, you can write. You can add in change colors for text and things like that. You can add pictures, things like that. And it actually works really, really well. I ran a game for a year with when I first started playing role-playing games at all, back in 2000 or maybe 1999. It was the Star Wars D6 system.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty soon after that, the Star Wars D20 system came out, and when I bought that book, I got a group together of my friends, and we played that for about 2 years or so. And we had a great time, and then the group just sort of fell apart. Well, years and years and years later, I'm friends with all of them on Facebook, and I said, do you guys want to get the crew back together? And so Yeah, and so we started playing with the original characters that we had back then.
You guys all still had your character sheets and things like that?
We didn't. And so what we ended up doing was we pretty much just went pure narrative. So it was pretty much a shared story more than a pure role-playing game. Mm-hmm. We initially tried to use the Star Wars D20 rules. Everybody ended up making characters all over again. Mm-hmm. To represent their characters, but it moved really, really, really slowly when you're doing play by post and trying to do combat. So we ended up switching much more to narrative, and basically with a lot of trust that everybody was gonna not god mod it and everything like that. So then that campaign ran for a full year and ended with two of the characters finally admitting their feelings for one another. One of the characters ended up dying to saving the rest of the group, and then the girl in the group, Kate, she ended up writing up a whole epilogue that was what happened years later, and it showed the characters' kids and things like that.
Wow.
And we were just going to sort of end it there, because she was going off with her husband to... he was going to Princeton, and so she was going to be moving across the country, and everybody was going to be very busy. My wife was having a baby around that time, and so we were just going to sort of stop, and then, like, it must have been a month later, she wrote to me and was like, we all kind of want to start playing again. So we got the group back together again, and now we're running with brand new characters. They're all Rebellion-era characters, and they're currently split up. Half the group is in front of Jabba the Hutt in chains. The other half is fleeing across the desert, being chased by TIE fighters, and it's actually been a lot of fun. There's... everybody chose specifically characters that weren't like their old characters. But the cool thing is that because everything was written in a present tense. Mm-hmm. So what Kate has done is she's been going through and changing everything to past tense. And she's actually been assembling it into a book format. And what we're going to end up doing is putting the entire thing, making it into a big book, and then making a physical copy for all of us members, so that we'll basically have a Star Wars novel of our exploits.
Wow. It sounds like you have a fantastic group.
I do have a fantastic group. They all put... it's really, really weird. They're completely unlike any other group I've ever experienced. They actually put in the effort to doing backstories, and there was a lot of emotional character pull. One of actually Kate's character ended up finding out that her boyfriend from the Jedi Academy was actually alive and well, that the Jedi Council had lied to her and he turned to the dark side, and he ended up corrupting her and turning her to the dark side. The group came to redeem her, and then she ended up like fighting them and finally turning against her boyfriend and killing him, and it got really, really complicated and stuff. So it was a lot of fun,
you're lucky, but, man, Mark.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And the good thing is with the group now is that they don't have quite as much, because these aren't characters that they've known since we were all 16.
Sure.
But if you're looking at going for a game that's much more heavy on the role play and less on combat, then that is definitely the way I would suggest you go.
I agree. My little experience of play by post has been very much the same thing. You get a lot more into your characters and speak in character more and work on the relationships between characters and with NPCs and so on. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
One of the fantastic things is that I've actually, because they're currently dealing with a bunch of gangsters and stuff, that all the gangsters are speaking in Huddies. And I'm able to do that because it's play-by-post. I would never be able to do that at a table because I don't speak Huddies. I know a few phrases here and there that I've learned from the movies and things like that.
Sure.
But beyond saying, Ejuta, I don't have any ability, whereas I'm having the characters, like these gangsters, carrying on full conversations back and forth because there's Huddies translators out there and things like that.
Right. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's worked really, really well, and I look forward to seeing where we end up going with this current game, and maybe we'll end up with a another book out of it. But we specifically said we need to make sure that everybody's writing in past tense this time, so it's a lot less work to translate over.
Convert it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that just shows that there's, in the age of the internet, if you want to game with friends who are far away, or make new friends, I mean, the people I play with in my regular online campaign are people I met through you know, online gaming. There's just so many options out there. It can really bring people together.
Absolutely. So I think that's about all we have to talk about with online gaming. Do you have anything else you wanted to add to the discussion?
You know, I'll just say that if you ever are looking to play online, especially if you're willing to DM online, there are always people out there. You know, I tend to find them on EN World, but I know there's people in lots of different places. I've run the occasional game for new players, and I have an ongoing game that I've been running since July of 2010, where I have the same original five players are still in the game. We've added a couple more over time, too, so people have flexibility. And it's people from across the U.S., and one guy who originally was in London, and now he's in Japan, but he's still... No matter what the weird hour is, whether he's waking up at 2 a.m. to play when he was in London or 9 a.m. the next day when he's in Japan, still sticks with the campaign and gets together to play with us. So it's a pretty amazing experience.
Excellent. Yeah, and I found just putting out on Twitter saying, hey, I'm going to be running a game, you know, in a week or tonight, and seeing who bites and hops on board. So
yeah,
there's lots of ways to get people.
And with something like MapTool, for me, I like that I have kind of a library of games now. So if I have people who want to play a game, just not people who I've been playing with for a long time, you know, like introducing new players, I probably have a short adventure that I've run before that's ready to go. You know, I have all the monsters statted up, and the maps are there. I don't have to track down minis or redraw the maps. I can just say, sure, let's go, and run a game. So it's pretty cool to have this technology to help us out at the table.
Absolutely. So let's go ahead and move into the final segment. This is a segment that we still want to do, where we sort of help people out with their campaigns, any issues they're having. You can always call us at 919-BIZ-TOME or leave a comment over on the feed here and ask for any advice you need about your campaign, and me and whoever the guest host will be able to help you out. But since we don't have anything this week, I was actually going to sort of ask you about what campaigns you're currently you currently have going on. You mentioned the mid Paragon tier game.
Sure. Yeah. So I have two campaigns that I'm starting to gear up for. One of those is going to be for low level characters using the Zeitgeist campaign saga that's coming out from EN World. That's actually a campaign I play tested as a play by post and really enjoyed it. So I'm looking forward to running it. And I have another campaign that I'm getting ready to run for my family. This is the online thing with my wife and her brother and his wife, which is going to be the Madness at Gardmore Abbey campaign.
Oh, excellent.
Very much looking forward to. But my mid Paragon campaign, this is my online game for Friday nights. They are just hitting 15th level, and we're playing the War of the Burning Sky campaign from EN World, which was originally a third edition campaign, and they adapted to fourth. And cool story. I'm really enjoying it. But since this is the chance where we get to ask Mark for advice, thought maybe I'd throw some your way. So,
yeah.
My characters are in a situation where they've come to this monastery looking for help from the two brothers that run the monastery. They're sort of masters of the winds, and there's a firestorm nearby that they need the wind master's help to blow away the firestorm so they can get into this castle that's surrounded by a firestorm. At this point, I'm trying to figure out a smooth way that doesn't feel awkward to show the party what's going on in this valley where this monastery is. And what's happening is they're en route to another part of the valley away from the monastery where there will be monsters and so on. And I'm not entirely satisfied with the monsters that are in the adventure. And specifically, the adventure talks about how this is a valley of storms is what it's called. And yet the monsters they fight, there's some monks, and then there's some undead creatures and things like that. And that just doesn't feel very Valley of Storms to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions where I can look for inspiration of good monsters. They can be elementals. They can be beasts. They could be, I mean, these are mid-Paragon, so these could be pretty crazy monsters if you want them to be. That would be fun and exciting to throw into a place called the Valley of Storms. And also any suggestions for cool, you know, environmental effects or things to keep in mind when I'm drawing up the maps for these fights.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's it's called the Valley of Storms because it's always, there's always storms going on.
Exactly. The general idea. You got it. Yep.
Well, one, the natural thought is you can throw in some wind and lightning elementals, mm-hmm. Things like that, which is, that's the obvious one. But what if you had a tribe or village of storm genasi?
Hmm.
You could have an entire village of who sort of channel those winds and storms and everything to sort of help aid them in doing genocide things. they can maybe they've got some type of, if you had it, you know, not a tribe, so they were more like more modern for the time period. Mm-hmm. People, you could have, they could have the entire city run on electricity and storms and things like that, and they could use their natural abilities just help channel that to power things around the village, and you could even, you know, make it magical so it doesn't seem like they're just a bunch of steampunk,
right?
You know, Victorian era type things.
Yeah, it's not an Eberron campaign exactly. But I like that idea. I think in this particular campaign, it was written before whichever book. I think it was Player's Handbook 2 or the Genocide. Oh, Forgotten Realms campaign, yeah. Right? That's right, where the Genocide came out. And there aren't any Genocide in this world, but I think that using the Genocide as inspiration for the kind of monsters that might live here, you know, the intelligent monsters that might live in a place called the Valley of Storms, and maybe they command lightning elementals and things like that. Now, what about environmental effects or interesting locales that we might want to see here? Do you have any suggestions as to what I might want to look for to make a battle more interesting in a Valley of Storms?
You could definitely have, in the middle of a battle, have the area flooding. And each round, you could start with maybe a thin stream that would be one square. Mm-hmm. Each round, roll a d20. On an 11 or higher, the stream increases on both sides by one square.
Mm-hmm.
So it begins to steadily flood more and more, and then once it gets past a certain point, maybe three squares out, then the center square becomes, it would become more than, like, the water would normally not slow you down, but it might, there might be the chance that you could slip and fall,
sure.
But it would become difficult.
Start sweeping you away,
exactly,
as the water gets deeper.
Yeah,
I think we could have some more, you know, air genocide to start with, but maybe as the water rises, you know, a water genocide shows up with some of his beast companions, whatever those might be, and makes the battle more complicated.
Yeah, and then after you've gotten three squares out, suddenly that middle line becomes difficult terrain,
mm-hmm.
and then each round that, you know, each time you rolled and the water expanded, then that would also more and more become difficult terrain, and then you could even maybe have a further step where it would be you can't even move through it. Difficult, you have to, you know, roll for swimming.
And I think for these mid Paragon characters, I can definitely throw a lot at them. I mean, they're mm-hmm. pretty tough to handle, so I'd probably go straight to something more than difficult terrain, just because they can handle difficult terrain. I'm not worried about them on that.
Yeah.
But I think that the idea of having something like that, a stream that becomes a river that becomes a raging deluge partway through the battle, mm-hmm. As things get worse and the storms intensify, I think it could work very well. So,
and
excellent suggestions.
You could also throw in with, if you have a driving rain, the rain could be hampering anybody's ranged attacks.
Sure, yeah, provide concealment or something like that. And give the chance of, you know, some kind of mischance. It could, you know, go off target.
Yeah. Oh, you could have the Genasi. I thought of this because I have a really badass Storm Titan figure,
mm-hmm.
Mini, that is, he's holding some lightning bolts in his hands and everything. You could have the Genasi serving a Storm Titan, which I think the Storm Titan is well beyond mid Paragon range.
Sure, but I could adapt.
But you could definitely have that. You can definitely, using the monster builder, easily bring the monsters his level down to be sort of like, maybe they have to finally take down this Storm Titan, and it's your world. You can, I know a lot of people, they don't like to mess with the canon of the world and to change things, but, and you can definitely, maybe if you kill the Storm Titan, then it's, the sky is suddenly clear, and for the first time, you know, in centuries, the Valley of Storms has seen sunlight, and you know, maybe that would, it could begin to change things.
I like that idea, and I think that, you know, creating monsters at this point for me has gotten easier. I do love the monster builder. The online one is better now. I've been using a tool called Power Tool a lot. That's another great
online tool. Yeah, I use that too.
Know about. But for me, when I'm creating these days on the fly, I have some macros in Map Tool where I just take a generic monster and I can say I want it to be, you know, level 14, an elite soldier, and it'll stat it all up for me with the generic you know, defenses, and then I can just, you know, tweak it from there, add in whatever powers I want. So, and then it's all ready to go. It's in Map Tool already. So, so yeah, it's very easy for me to create monsters on the fly or adapt existing monsters. And I think those are some excellent suggestions. Thank you very much, Mark.
Yeah. Oh, and if you wanted to add in some moral quandaries, you could have, without really mentioning it, have the players, you know, take down the Storm Titan and kill him. Well, then what does that do to the whole livelihood of the Storm Genasi, who have their village that requires the storms?
The entire ecology of the region is now completely changed. And...
yeah, and the players are to blame.
Creating new complications. Always
exactly.
Fun.
So, excellent.
Great. Well, see everybody out there. You should be calling in, because obviously Mark's got great suggestions.
Yeah, and we'll answer any and all questions. I'm hoping next month, this will be the first he hears about it when he hears the episode. But I'm hoping to get my dad on the show.
Fun.
My dad played D&D back when it was called Chainmail.
Wow.
So, yeah, he's got a lot. And he stopped playing around the time that my older brother was born, and didn't play again until last Christmas when I ran a game for my entire family, my mom and dad and brother and sister-in-law and my wife. And so he got to experience what D&D is like now. So I'm hoping to get him on next episode to talk about what life was like for gaming back years and years and years ago. So, yeah.
So everybody out there who wants campaign advice from Mark or from Papa Meredith, 919-BIZ-TOME.
That's right. 919-BIZ-TOME. So I think that's all we have. Thanks a lot for tuning in.